Last one, our third topic this morning is complementing one another with an I instead of an E. Complementing, this is about communication. This is one of the ways we maintain true love. This is an article from the Wall Street Journal not too long ago, just in February. It's titled Dealing with the Dead Zone, Spouses Too Tired to Talk. It starts out, Michael Hickey knows better than to try to start a conversation with his wife when she gets home from work. After a hard day at the office, quote, I'm definitely too tired to talk at night, says Karen Ambrose of Palo Alto, California, a senior marketing executive. I'll put up a brick wall. Michael, an engineer, the husband here, says he's resigned regardless of what's on his mind when Karen comes home. He says you just have to wait until later. Finding time to talk is an ongoing struggle, the dead zone. I don't know if you've experienced that. Exhausted lives that we lead, we often end up in this moment where we're not talking to each other. We have this kind of dead zone at home. On our other end of the spectrum, often couples deal with the war zone as the other way to think about our communication. On the other end of the spectrum, there's a little account. Married life is very frustrating. In the first year of marriage, the man speaks and the woman listens. In the second year, the woman speaks and the man listens. In the third year, they both speak and the neighbors listen. That's kind of the war zone. You have these two things that go on. Oftentimes, we either have this silence that occurs in marriage because of exhaustion, because of other factors, because of conflict. We have the dead zone, or we end up with the war zone, this kind of constant bickering of speaking to each other in ways that are not redemptive and are not really meant to build one another up, but to tear one another down, the war zone imagery. Communication is so important to our marriages, so I wanted to kind of focus on that, complementing one another. Think back again. I always take you back to creation because you have this first picture of a husband and wife and how they relate to one another. Think what Adam does when he first rests his eyes upon his wife, Eve. He bursts forth in speech. He talks about her. He talks with her. He speaks well of her. He compliments her. The first thing, if you think about it, the first recorded words of humanity prior to the fall in the Bible itself are a husband praising his wife. You are bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. That's really the only words that are recorded before the fall, are the assuring compliments of a husband to a wife. Redemptive, beautiful speech complimenting one another. We looked at kind of complimenting one another in the sense of roles and how we fit together and make harmonious relationships. Now, let's look at this idea of complimenting one another, speaking redemptively to one another, praising one another. And this comes out in spades in the book of Song of Songs. There's tons of information about complimenting. We have here, of course, poetry. And so we see a lot of complimentary speech. What I want to do this morning is look briefly at four forms of complimentary speech, four ways to speak to one another redemptively, drawn from the Song of Songs. The four are these. We have compliments of assurance, compliments of praise, compliments of comparison, and compliments of satisfaction. Assurance, praise, comparison, satisfaction. Those four types of speech patterns. And of course, it's not the whole of all types of way to speak to one another, but it's a great little thing to think about, these four ways of complimenting one another: assurance, praise, comparison, and satisfaction. Let's look at the first of these. We'll look at the first one in more detail, then I'm going to be brief on the last three. Compliments of assurance. Turn with me in the Song of Songs to chapter 1 of the Song of Songs. I'll give you a nice little taste of this. Compliments of assurance. One of the basic understood part of our nature as human beings is that we are people with insecurities, a variety of insecurities. And it's important for us as spouses to recognize our spouse's insecurities and to speak to them in assuring ways about those insecurities. This is one of the kind of one of the ways you can tell the health of a marriage. We have insecurities. Our spouses know them. We know that. We learn each other. Your spouse knows all your weaknesses. In destructive marriages, spouses take those weaknesses, those insecurities, and they exploit them. They use them to degrade one another. Those are the buttons that you push in a moment when you want to hurt somebody. And redemptive marriage is just the opposite happens. Those insecurities, those places of our weakness are used by our spouse as ways to affirm one another. That we specifically speak well of each other in those areas, we assure one another instead of degrading one another. That's one of the great tests of a marriage, when you're sitting with people and you're doing counseling and you see, are they pushing those buttons? Yeah, they're saying, well, listen, you know, you're always had that problem. Rather than saying, you know, honey, you're really doing well at that or whatever. So, and here we find an example of a compliment of assurance right in the book of the Song of Songs, right at the beginning, over the issue of physical appearance, which is oftentimes an issue for people in men and women in our culture, feeling insecure about their physical appearance. Let's look together at Song of Songs, chapter 1, verses 5 through 11, and a compliment of assurance. Chapter, verse 5, this is the woman speaking. Dark am I, yet lovely. O daughters of Jerusalem, dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I am darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards. My own vineyard I have neglected. Tell me, you whom I love, where you graze your flock and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? Verse 8, if you do not know, most beautiful of women, follow the tracks of the sheep, this is the man speaking here, and graze your young goats by the tents of the shepherds. I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels. We will make you earrings of gold studded with silver. And there's this kind of going back and forth, these two lovers are communicating to one another. She begins in this first chapter of the songs here by immediately expressing her own perception of her physical appearance. In verse 5, she says, dark am I, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. At first, she sounds like she's kind of comfortable with herself, right? Dark am I, yet lovely. But then she expresses this basic insecurity about her appearance. And that's in verse 6. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I am darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards, my own vineyard I have neglected. She doesn't want him to stare at her. She's ashamed or insecure about something about her appearance. And it's particularly here because of her complexion. She has dark skin. In our culture, dark skin is prized. It's a wonderful thing. It's a thing we would all like to have. Tan skin is something beautiful. It's a prized element of beauty. But in this time, in this age, it was not a sign of beauty. It was a sign that you were working with your hands, that you were a laborer. And for a woman to be working as a laborer showed that she was poor and didn't place her among the noble people, low class, if you want to say. And she's ashamed of her appearance, ashamed of her dark skin. And you get the imagery here when she says in verse 6, my mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyard. She was forced into labor and she's embarrassed by how she's looking. She responds about this perceived neglect. She says her own physical beauty, she uses the metaphor of her own vineyard, she is not taken care of. That verse 6, my mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards, these physical vineyards, and I got darkened skin. My own vineyard, that is my own beauty, I have neglected. I've been put in this terrible position, and I'm insecure about it. Don't stare at me. I don't like the way I look. We can all kind of relate to that. We all recognize that physical appearance is one of the areas we have human insecurities. So what does this guy do? How does he respond to this? He responds with a compliment of assurance, much like Adam in the garden. He responds almost like the same thing. This is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. He responds with a compliment of assurance in verse 8. Look at verse 8. He tells her there, you are the most beautiful of women. He compliments her. He takes the area of her insecurity and he speaks well of her. He doesn't say, well, yeah, you're a little dark, but I guess you'll do. You know, he doesn't say a little cosmetic surgery will fix that. You know, you can be made, you know. He says, you are the most beautiful of women. He doesn't stop in verse 8. He builds on that compliment of assurance. Look at verses 9 through 11. He expands the compliment. He states the following of her there in verse 9. I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels. We will make you earrings of gold studded with silver. So here he goes, he kind of bursts into this poetic verse using all these metaphors to describe her physical beauty. And we can really grasp and grab a hold of those imageries of the jewelry and how that affects her beauty. But there's one metaphor here that's kind of hard for us to grasp in our culture at first glance. He begins the verse by comparing the woman to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Now, this is one of the rules you have in using the Song of Song. I wouldn't advise anybody to refer to a woman comparing her to a horse. That usually doesn't work in our culture as being a sense of flattering one's beauty. But we have to think about, okay, what did this mean in the ancient Near East? What's he saying there? You are like a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Well, it's interesting. Now, when military campaigns and war was made, it was made using chariots, and stallions were used as those who would, basically drive those chariots and power fuel them, give them motion. And one of the defense tactics that you had as a way to kind of get at your enemy, who had a lot of chariots with stallions driving them, is to take a mare in heat and throw the mare into the middle of the battlefield, driving the stallions crazy because of this mare and heat that's been introduced, and of course, kind of basically scrambles what we would think is their navigation system. And this is what the guy is kind of saying here to her. He's telling her, you're so beautiful that your beauty is utterly distracting to me. It's driving me crazy, if you will. It's this wonderful and expansive way of saying, you're so beautiful, you drive me to distraction. You're like a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh, confusing me. I can't think straight when you're around. Here she is. She's afraid. She's insecure about her beauty. And he responds by just building up this beautiful wall of assurance around her that he thinks she's the most beautiful of all. A compliment of assurance. That's really how we should talk to one another about our insecurities. Is to build up that beautiful type of redemptive speech that restores those things. We know where each other's weaknesses are. We should speak to one another, not using those as weapons, not using them to degrade or manipulate, but to use them as ways of healing, of encouraging, of affirming. And men and women will have those things in different places. Sometimes it is more often the case, not always the case, that women have it physically in their appearance, and men need to be attentive to that. But sometimes it's the other way around. Men have it too. We're not devoid of those things. Sometimes for men, it's insecurities in their professional career or their role in life, and then they need to be affirmed and say, honey, I respect you, or you're good at what you do. So compliments of assurance. It's one of the ways we do that. The second type of compliment I mentioned is compliments of pure praise. Pure praise. And this sounds kind of redundant at one level, because isn't a compliment praise itself? And yes, of course, that's true. But what I'm trying to drive at here is there are times when we are to compliment one another for no pragmatic purpose at all, just because we love to do it. I mean, the first one, the compliments of assurance, that has a pragmatic role. It's a way of filling in our insecurities, of encouraging one another. But now I'm talking about something that's totally done for just the joy of doing it. And this is what happens in the Song of Songs. If you look in the text with me, these two love to compliment one another. And in chapter 1, verses 15, down to chapter 2, verse 3, there's this wonderful exchange of kind of this banter, this loving, complimentary banter. Look at verse 15. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves. And she replies, how handsome you are, my lover. Oh, how charming are you, and our bed is verdant. The beams of our house are cedars and rafters are firs. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. Like a lily among thorns is my darling among the maidens. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade and to taste, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. You see this kind of almost childlike frivolity, this enjoyment. One commentator talks about the section of the Song of Songs as a duet of mutual admiration. This kind of singing together of one another's praise. That's a wonderful picture. You see that one example, particularly in verses 15 and 16. The man, how beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful, your eyes are doves. The woman, how handsome you are, my lover. Oh, how charming, and our bed is verdant. You see that just building up of one another, enjoying the craft of praising one another. And it's not some type of superficial, like, sappy flattery. It's not something, you know, on a, you find out on a cheap romance novel or a kind of, you know, those pastel greeting cards or something like that. It's really praise. It's welling up from the reservoir of love and enjoyment they have of one another. It's forged in the foundry of their hearts. It comes forward in this joyous, simple compliment of pure praise. A compliment for the sake of complimenting, because you love somebody. Loving spouses do that for each other. Pure praise. Out of the blue, no reason, nothing, not to get anything, but just to say, you're beautiful. You're wonderful. Thank you. Thirdly, compliments of comparison. Compliments of comparison. Comparison. There's a third category here of speech. And this type of compliment, the purpose of it is to show that there are no competitors, no rivals to your love, to your affection. No doubt that you're the only one, that you're number one and there are no rivals. And you see this in chapter 2, verses 2 through 3. Look at those verses. We just read them a minute ago, but look at them again. Like a lily among the thorns is my darling among the maidens. That's her speaking. I'm sorry, that's him speaking. She speaks now. Verse 3, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. You see what's doing there. The man kind of commences the speech there by comparing her to all the eligible women available, the maidens, he speaks of there. And then he sets her apart. You are a lily among thorns. Yeah, there's all these other women out there, but the thorns. You're the beautiful flower. You're the one. Set apart, distinct. There is no rival. You stand out. You are the only one who has my affections. A compliment of comparison. He does the same thing. She does the same thing. In symmetrical fashion, she responds with the same type of compliment. She takes all the eligible, the young men, and she uses the metaphor, you're like an apple tree among the trees of the forest. Now, what's going on there? She tells her lover, you are like this apple tree in the forest. There's like all these pine trees out there. But then there's this apple tree. Beautiful blossoms. Produces ripe and rich fruit. Sweet to the taste. That's what you're like among all the young men. No rivals. You stand head and shoulders above the rest. There's no comparison. The choice is clear. I have no rivals. You are the one for me. That's how we should speak to one another, husband and wife. There should be never a doubt of our affection, the exclusivity of our love. It's one of the themes of the Song of Songs is when she defines the nature of true love, she talks about it as being exclusive. She uses the imagery of the seal. Place me like a seal over your heart, she tells her husband. You know, make me your own. The seal is so identified with the personal identification of an individual. She says, make me like that. Incorporate me into your being. You are my exclusive love and I want it to be that way. That's why we have this, the two will become one flesh. There can be no triangulation. There can be no rivals. There can be no one else in your marriage. And this is one of the ways you do it is by complimenting one another, making sure that you are saying you are head and shoulders above all others who are out there who could vie for my affection. Of course, you can even take that to, when I talk about exclusivity, is the whole area of other things that can take your affections, not just other women or other men, in the case maybe, but other things that can do that. You are the one for me. Fourthly, is the compliments of satisfaction. Compliments of satisfaction. This is a way of expressing the reality that you find your complete romantic fulfillment in one another. That you find nothing lacking. You don't need to go anywhere else. This is the place that you find your physical, romantic satisfaction. Let me just look at one of those compliments of satisfaction. There are others, but just to give you an example of this in the Song of Songs, chapter 4, verses 10 and 11. This is the man speaking to his lover. Listen to what he says to her. Verse 10. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume than any spice. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like that of Lebanon. You see what he does there. He describes her love in this delightful, wonderful way as being such a satisfying thing. Her love is delightful, more pleasing than wine. He uses that imagery of wine. He talks about it, her lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, and that milk and honey are under her tongue. He's saying this is incredibly, rich and vivid picture of romantic satisfaction, of sexual satisfaction, spoken through metaphors, appropriately veiled in these kind of double entendres, these metaphors. And note what he uses there. He uses that imagery of milk and honey. There's two things in the ancient world which, depict the beauty and satisfaction and the goodness of the promised land itself. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. It's this beautiful and rich and satisfying place. It's this Edenic type of place that you're going to. And he says, this is what my relationship with you is like. My love with you is like this. It's fully satisfying. It's sweetness. It fully meets my needs. I am fully have my hunger satisfied here. So often the food analogy is used in the Song of Songs as a way of referring to sexual satisfaction. That's used, of course, here, wine and honeycomb and milk, and it's just a picture that this is where I go, and I'm totally filled, and I don't need to go anywhere else. Proverbs tells us about the importance of finding that satisfaction. In Proverbs 5:18-20, it says, "May your fountain be blessed." This is the father speaking to the son. "May your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breast satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love. Why be captivated, my son, by an adulteress? Why embrace the bosom of another man's wife?" This is a biblical calling. Find your satisfaction here. The Proverbs talks about drink from your own well, from your own cistern. Don't let your waters run through the streets. Find it here. And make sure your spouse knows that. Make sure that they're aware that you are totally physically satisfied, romantically satisfied, that you find it here. It's delightful. It's wonderful. It's with you alone. And I'm happy at home. That's one of the things we should communicate to one another. And the lovers in the song do that. It's a compliment of pure, total satisfaction. All right, let me give you some tips here about how do you do that? How do you kind of cultivate this complementary relationships? Because I'll tell you, one of the warning signs, kind of a first warning of a marriage going wrong is in this area of communication. The onset of marital decay really happens when spouses seek to speak compliments to one another. When we start to be grudging in our compliments, holding back. And of course, it eventually becomes the other end of the spectrum where it becomes bickering and tearing each other apart. But where it really begins is just the stopping of doing it. So, let me give you four suggestions about cultivating a complementary relationship. First, engage in self-assessment. Let's face it, some of us are by nature better at doing this than others. Sometimes I deal with engineers. Any engineers here? Do you know what an extroverted engineer does? I can tell if an engineer is an extrovert. They look at your shoes while they're talking to you. They're their own shoes. That's an extroverted engineer. So, I mean, some people are just not naturally wired to be those who compliment one another. You gotta ask yourself, am I good at this? And sometimes you're not. That's okay. People are formed differently, but it doesn't get you off the hook. If you're not naturally given to this, remember, this is not just some kind of like cheap toss-away lines. I mean, this is really thoughtful things. And you're gonna have to work at it. So ask yourself, am I good at this? And do I need to work at it? Well, how do you work at it? Well, you start by being purposeful and deliberate, by developing a vocabulary of praise, of acquainting yourself with romantic literature. Even the Song of Songs itself, great place to start. God's giving you this book. Read it. Think about it. Think about how they talk to one another. Find a way to begin developing that vocabulary. Make a conscious effort to do that. Talk to one another. See if you're wired that way. If you're not, work on it. Secondly, take time to think about your spouse. We don't often, our lives are busy. We don't often sit down after, maybe when you're courting, you think about your spouse and all their virtues, but sometimes you forget to do that. Think about your spouse. Take time and say, okay, what is it that, where are my spouse's insecurities? Do I consciously know? On a subconscious level, we all know. But do I think about where my spouse needs to be affirmed? And those things will change. And we had two kids in the last 3 years, and I never had to assure my wife about being a wonderful mother before until we had children. All of a sudden, that was a new element of our marriage relationship, and I knew it. She needs to hear, because although I'm thinking all the time, she's the greatest mother in the world, I wouldn't want her job in a million years, she's great, I can't do this, you know, I think about all those things, but she's thinking sometimes, you know, I'm not a good mom. And I know she's thinking that. It's wrong, and I want to make sure she knows it's wrong. So we need to think about, where are our spouse's insecurities? Where can I assure them? Why do you find your spouse attractive? Tell them why. Tell them why. What sets my spouse apart from all others? What is that unique thing that you know, even when you court them, even now today, that sets them apart, that makes, you know, in comparison to everyone else, that makes them a lily among thorns or an apple tree in the forest? And how does my spouse please and satisfy me? And tell them. Talk. Vocalize. So think about your spouse. Thirdly, recognize that compliments need not be restricted to the area of physical beauty and romance. They don't have to be. This is not just about physical beauty and romance, but think about Proverbs 31. A husband should praise his wife for her work, it tells us. And that these things should be even more highly esteemed than physical beauty. In Proverbs 31, it states, her children arise and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her the reward she has earned, and let her works bring her praise at the city gate. Think about this. This is more than just beauty and those type of things. It's these wonderful godly attributes of our spouses. Things they do well, to extol them for those things. And of course, on the other side, a wife should do the same thing with her husband. Praise him for his work as a father and a husband. For his work outside the home, the things he does well. Fourth and finally, learn to find joy in complimenting your spouse. Really, this is supposed to be fun. These kind of lovers in the song, they're having fun with this. Learn to revel in it, to make it a labor of love, to enjoy doing it, to find it enjoyable, to kind of have that type of banter of complimenting one another. And don't underestimate the power of this. I know at one level you can think about it, so, well, you know, I'm not talking about mere throwaway lines. Words can heal or they can kill. There's no doubt about it. That's why the Bible so frequently talks about the importance of controlling our tongue, bridling our tongue, the forest fire it can create. Proverbs always talks about wise communication. Words can degrade or they can edify. You can adorn your spouse or you can tear them down. And Tremper Longman and Dan Allender have a very good book on marriage called Intimate Allies. And they talk about the use of speech in that book and how we should talk to one another. And they speak about how God created the world through words. He spoke the world into existence, brought life and order out of chaos and emptiness. And they suggest that we are to follow that pattern in our marriages. They write, God also calls husbands and wives to use our words to push back the chaos and shape our lives into order and beauty. He calls us to use our words to bring life to those who hear them. So, in addition to making love, expanding that idea, make sure you're saying love. You say it. Barbara Dawn talks about this in her book. She says, whether the love saying is wild and passionate or gentle and consoling, whether it is laughing and crazy or serious and divulging, it is always speaks faithfulness. Each time we say love, it is a covenant, a spiritual act. It is a reminder that we have promised to be faithful, that we are knit together in this special bond of oneness for the purposes of God. It's a way to forge your bonds of oneness. Just as Adam, the first words have said, this is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Compliment one another. And just like every other aspect, once again it takes us to God. God is that husband who speaks sweet words to us. Think about how God speaks to us. We have all that imagery of him giving us his law, right? Psalm 19, he gives us his law, which is what? Sweet as honeycomb. He speaks sweet words to us, even in the law. He's a God who speaks wonderful things. He delights in us. He delights in his bride. He speaks well of his bride. He doesn't degrade us and tear us down and tell us how awful we are. He speaks wonderful things. He delights. Psalm 149, verse 4, for the Lord takes delight in his people. He crowns the humble with salvation. Isaiah 62, 5, as a young man marries a maiden, so will your sons marry you. As a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you. Zephaniah 3:17, the Lord your God is with you. He is mighty to save. He will take great delight in you. He will quiet you with his love. He will rejoice over you with singing. God singing over. I mean, this is a beautiful picture. The bridegroom loves his bride. He loves to speak well of her, to edify her, to build her up, to wash her with water, to speak words which do not tear her down, but build her up and into a beautiful house. I mean, he wants to cleanse with his word. Right, he uses his word in Ephesians chapter 5 to cleanse, to make a radiant church free of stains and wrinkle, to render his bride holy and blameless. Jesus, even though we are, Jesus doesn't call his bride a whore. He doesn't use that language, does he? He calls us his bride. He doesn't take our insecurities and point them out. That's what the devil does. Jesus always affirms his bride, "How fair and beautiful you are, my bride." That's what Jesus does to all of us. Shouldn't we emulate that in our marriage and how we speak to one another, redemptively to one another? Not tearing down, not ripping apart, but healing and building up. We're to compliment one another. In just the last minutes I have left, I wanted to give a concluding thing. I'll let you have a couple comments, but just a brief conclusion to the whole day here together. And I appreciate your patience. You've been very attentive. I mentioned how the Bible begins with a man and a woman in a garden, and they're naked and they have no shame. The Song of Songs really, in a biblical theological way, a redemptive historical way, is picturing that garden again and how to get back there. Here in the Song of Songs, just like in Genesis, you have a man and a woman in a garden. And the Song of Songs is rife with garden imagery. The word is used numerous times. I'll give you a couple of examples. Chapter 4, verse 12, "You are a garden locked up, my sister." Even refers to her as a paradise in that verse. Verse 15, "You are a garden fountain, a well flowing with water." Chapter 5, verse 11, "I have come into my garden." Chapter 6, verse 2, "My lover has gone down to his garden." Chapter 8, verse 13, "You dwell in the gardens." It's all this picture of a man and woman in a garden. That garden language is on purpose. It's to remind us of the Garden of Eden. Raymond Dillard and Trevor Longman write about the Song of Songs. "When we turn to the Song of Songs, we see the man and his wife in the garden, naked and feeling anything but shame. The book pictures the restoration of human love to its pre-fall bliss." That's what the purpose of this book is, to remind us how in Christ we can live in that garden again. Now, having said that, and having said all these wonderful things about marriage and all this, I want to make sure I don't leave you with the idea that marriage is the end of all of our happiness and satisfaction, because it's not. And the Bible reminds us about that. And I try to remind young couples when they find each other, true happiness is not found in marriage. It's found beyond the walls of this world. Our ultimate longings, even though our culture has all these romantic images that we're going to find everything we need in a marriage relationship, this is the epitome of what it is to be human. It's not. And if you look to your marriage for your ultimate happiness, you will always be disappointed. Cornelius Plantinga writes, "Even if we fall deeply in love and marry another human being, we discover that our spiritual and sexual oneness isn't final. It's wonderful, but not final. It might even be as good as human oneness can be, but something in us keeps saying, not this or still beyond. The truth is, nothing in this earth can finally satisfy us. Much can make us content for a time, but nothing can fill us to the brim." That's why Apostle Paul tells us we wait patiently for something we do not yet have. Marriage is supposed to remind us of that, of point us to that ultimate marriage relationship with Christ, what we're waiting for. It's fulfilling, it's wonderful, but there's something still beyond the walls of this world that's not found in a marriage. And that's only found in our consummation of our marriage to Christ. So always remember that. I'll close with this. The Song of Songs is a poem. Anne Bradstreet wrote poems about the Song of Songs. This is one of hers. Built on the Song of Songs, "A weary pilgrim now at rest. A pilgrim I on earth perplexed, with sins, with cares and sorrows vexed, by age and pains brought to decay, and my clay house moldering away. Oh, how I long to be at rest, and soar on high among the blessed. This body shall in silence sleep, mine eyes no more shall ever weep, no fainting fits shall me assail, nor grinding pains my body frail. With cares and fear ne'er cumbered be, nor losses know, nor sorrows see. But though my flesh shall there consume, it is the bed Christ did perfume. And when a few years shall be gone, this mortal shall be clothed upon. A corporate carcass down it lies, a glorious body it shall rise. In weakness and dishonor sown, in power 'tis raised by Christ alone. Then soul and body shall unite, and of their Maker have the sight. Such lasting joy shall there behold, as ear ne'er heard, nor tongue e'er told. Lord, make me ready for the day. Then come, dear Bridegroom, come away. The Spirit and the Bride say, come. And let him who hears say, come. Whoever is thirsty, let him come. And whoever wishes, let him take the free gift of the water of life. That's the ultimate satisfaction we have, our marriage with Christ. And our earthly marriages can only point us there, and only really give us a foretaste of what is to come. Any comments or questions as we close, and I'll dismiss this in prayer, if there are not any. Please feel free to come up afterwards. Any? All right, great. Let me close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time together this morning, this time to reflect on this wonderful gift you've given us. What an enormous, amazing privilege it is, and all the billions of people on the earth, that you help us to find our soulmate, the one who brings us joy, that we even find each other in this massive world, that you bring us together and you give us this picture of who we were created to be and who we will become with Christ. May we use our marriages, Lord, to glorify you. May we enjoy them, and may they always remind us and point us and make us yearn for our ultimate marital union in its full consummation sense with Jesus Christ. And may we look forward to that great wedding supper of the Lamb. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all for your attention. It's been fun this morning too. Thank you. Have a good, enjoy.